Well, thank you so much, Sister Biles, and we appreciate the message and song and the enthusiasm. I never like to go to a funeral unless I'm really going to one. And thank you for the wonderful presentation this morning. In your Bibles this morning, in Song of Songs, Shir HaShirim, chapter 2. And while you're turning to that, I want to share with you a poem or two. The famous bard of Scotland, Robert Burns, wrote, "My love is like a red, red rose that's newly sprung in June. Oh, my love is like the melody that's sweetly played in tune. So fair art thou, my bonny lass, so deep in love am I, and I will love thee still, my dear, till all the sea's gone dry. Till all the sea's gone dry, my dear, and all the rocks melt with the sun. I will love thee still, my dear, while the sands of life shall run. And fare thee well, my only love, and fare thee well a while. I will come again, my love, though it were 1,000 miles. Another relatively famous individual who will be known to some of you, Sila Lennon, wrote, "A special world for you and me, a special bond one cannot see. It wraps us up in its cocoon and holds us fiercely in its womb. Its fingers spread like fine spun gold, gently nestling us to the foe. Like silken thread, it holds us fast. Bonds like this are meant to last. And though at times a thread may break, a new one forms in its wake to bind us closer and keep us stronger in a special world where we belong. And yet for all the beauty of human poetry about love, both of the persons whose poems I just read to you ended up their lives, relatively short lives, in sorrow and brokenheartedness over love affairs." And so it is that when we come to the song, we come to a different kind of literature. R.B. Dembski wrote the following, quote, "If this book, the Song of Solomon, were read in its literal significance and its lessons laid to heart, today there would be fewer unhappy marriages contracted purely from lust of money or of body. The remedy for the licentiousness of much of modern society can be found only in such ideal concepts of the nature of love and the human relations as this book enshrines. It is an atmosphere so pure, so sweet, so true, that we must recover it if we would recover the stability of the home and of family life. The book reminds us that true romance is not dead in the world, and that the ideal of human love remains a reality, and the highest forms of human happiness lie in the simpler, truer, and more satisfying forms of human affection and devotion." With that in mind, I want to point you today to the second chapter of the book of the Song of Songs. It is not primarily a sex manual, as some people have imagined and have written. And some of those who have written books along that line, I count among my dearest friends. And I thank God for their effort to treat the book as it stands as a literal statement. But I want you to know that it is not preeminently a manual about sex. There is no doubt that sex is implied at certain points, and we will point those out as we go along. But what is actually found in the book is a recipe to have a happy life with your spouse. What is actually enshrined in the book is a method of discovery of real love, Because real love is a great deal more, though certainly not less, than sexual intimacy. So follow with me today in the second chapter as we read. Like a lily among thorns, so is my love among the daughters. Like an apple tree among the trees of the woods, so is my beloved among the sons. I shall sit down in his shade with great delight, and his fruit was sweet to my taste. He brought me into the banqueting house, and his banner over me was love. Sustain me with the cakes of raisins and refresh me with apples, for I am lovesick. His left hand was under my hand, and his right hand embraces me. I charge you, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the gazelles and the does of the field, do not stir up or awaken love until it pleases. Well, then the Shulamite continues, the voice of my beloved, behold, he comes, leaping up on the mountains, skipping up on the hills. My beloved is like a gazelle or a young stag. Behold, he stands behind the wall, and he's looking through the windows and gazing through the lattice. My beloved spoke and said to me, rise up, my love, my fair one, and come away. For lo, the winter is past, and the rain is gone, and the flowers appear on the earth, and the time of singing has come, and the voice of the turtle dove is heard in the land. The fig tree puts forth green figs, and the vines with the tender grapes a good smell. Rise up, my love, O fair one, and come away, O my dove, in the clefts of the rock, in the secret places of the cliff. Let me see your face, and let me hear your voice, for your voice is sweet, and your face is lovely. Now there's a problem, however, and we come now to it. Catch us the foxes, the little foxes that spoil the vines. Hence the title of today's message, The Foxes in Your Love Life. For our vines have tender grapes. My beloved is mine, and I am his. He feeds his flocks among the lilies. Until the day breaks and the shadows flee away, turn, my beloved, and be like a gazelle or a young stag upon the mountains of Bethel. And so this unusual second chapter introduces us to some facets of genuine love, and I don't want you to miss them. The first one I want you to see in the first few verses is the pleasure of love. The second one I want you to see, beginning in verse 8, is the playfulness of love. And finally, in verses 15 and following, I want you to notice the purposefulness of love. Well, let's look at them, if we may. The pleasures of love. As Solomon thinks about his wife, or this, at this point, perhaps the one who's going to be his wife, he says, she is like a lily among the thorns. Now, if I were a woman and did not happen to be his beloved, I believe I would take an exception to that. He has just called everybody else in the cabinet, in the group of the palace ladies, he has called them all thorns. But I don't think he meant to do that so much as he meant to contrast his own view of his own love. And folks, that's the way it ought to be. The one that God has uniquely given to you, she is to be a lily among the thorns. And what does that suggest to you? Well, that suggests access to her, but have you ever felt the prick of a thorn? Listen, if you get involved with some other woman, other than your wife, you will feel the prick of the thorn. It seems to be so hopeful. It seems to meet the need so greatly, but watch out. It's a thorn because she is not God's chosen for you. As Solomon thought about the Shulamith, he could only see her as the beautiful lily in the midst of all the thorns. He wasn't being uncomplimentary of others. He was simply saying, she is mine. And so a beautiful statement that is not intended to be uncomplimentary at all. She is like an apple tree among the trees of the woods. Now, why did he choose an apple tree? The actual word in the Hebrew language is tapuach. And I wonder if we have one there. We have a beautiful apple tree. We're not quite sure that the word means apple. Maybe it means a quince. And do we have a quince tree there? Yes. So whether it means apple or whether it means quince, you see what beautiful, beautiful trees are they. What you may not know if you've never been around any of these is that whether it is a quince or whether it is an apple, in the orchard, they always reveal themselves by the pleasantness of their scent. Other trees are there and may be beautiful. They may bring forth fruit, but the apple and the quince tree are both famous in the springtime for the scent of that tree. And so he says, when I think of my love, well, it's like an apple tree among the trees of the woods, and my beloved among the sons. I have sat down in the shade with great delight, and his fruit was sweet to my taste. The word sweet there to taste is matok in Hebrew. It literally means to smack your lips, as though you were reaching into the jar of honey when your wife wasn't looking and taking a fingerful and swiping it across your tongue, and you would smack your lips. Oh, yes, just the presence of his beloved was like the taste of honey and caused him to smack his lips. Well, the Shulamite responds, and she says, he brought me to the banqueting house, and his banner over me was love. Now we live in a day and a time of egalitarianism. All men and all women are exactly the same. You have no distinctions made. It's not a matter of their equality in essence. The Bible was one of the earliest books, if not the very earliest book ever written, to affirm the full equality of men and women. Adam looked up from his surgery, and as the anesthetic wore off, he caught sight of Eve. You know what he said? No, it's none of your business, what he said. Very frankly, there's just a little bit given to you that is necessary for faith and understanding. And he said, this is bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called Isha because she was taken out of Ish. She shall be called woman, not from woe is man, as some have imagined, but it is the old Anglo-Saxon word, womb man, but you can't say womb man, so the MB eventually dropped out, but she is the woman, the one that has the womb. Now, in so saying, Adam made two declarations. Number one, she is bone of my bones, flesh of my flesh. Whatever it is that I am, there is another one with certain marked improvements. And so he declares that she is fully equal to him. And there is no question but that each, Adam and Eve, man and woman, made in the Imago Dei, made to be responsible to God. Each must be responsible for himself or herself. But there is in the very text also a distinction. She is the man, the one that has the womb. Her responsibilities are different. Now, I know that many of you may suspect that I am pregnant. That is not true, of course. It is an optical illusion. But in fact, it is not possible at all. That is not an assignment that God has given to me. He has given to men and to women very opposite assignments. And we are only in the will of God when we remain true to the assignments that God has given us. So let the whole world be egalitarian. Let the whole world insist, if it will, on the full equality of man and woman, meaning that they are no different at any place. But you must decide whether or not the Bible is the sufficient Word of God or not. If the Bible is the sufficient Word of God, then the husband, for example, is given the responsibility of caring for the wife. You see that in the text right here. He brought me into his banqueting house, and his banner that waved over me was the banner of love. Now, there isn't a thing suggested here in the text about that being sexual intimacy. What is being suggested here is the kind of love that the Bible speaks about in God's love for us. Other person-oriented, self-deprecating love. I love you not for what you can do for me. I love you for what I can do for you. Do you know that in all of these years of marital counseling, that I must have seen too many thousands of people in my office? They come in and they sit on opposite ends of the couch and they glare at one another. So I venture forth the suggestion that it may not be going well with them in their marriage. And for the first time in several months, they agree on something together. They both shake their heads. Yes, that's true. And so I say to them, would it be true that you have almost become enemies of one another? And they say, yes, that's absolutely true. We are like enemies living in the same house. To which I say, we have just resolved the problem. And they look at me with strange eyes. And they say, how did we resolve the problem? And I said, well, the Bible says, love your enemy. And so we have just resolved the whole problem right there. Now listen, folks, I have never had couples come in and face me with problems in their marriage, except that they had completely forgotten the godly meaning of love. That love is not what I get, love is what I give. And I can testify safely within my own marriage that when we've had a problem about something, almost inevitably, I am the problem, and I have forgotten that love is what I give, not what I get. Now, I want to tell you that Mrs. Patterson, in all candor, is not an easy person to let your banner wave over her in love. She comes to this matter of submission to her husband solely and completely on the basis of the Bible. I'm telling you, there is nothing naturally in her about it. Those of you who know her, you don't know the half of the story. She has energies beyond anything that you can possibly imagine, and little sympathy for me when I need a little sympathy. Get on up and get moving. You'll be okay. Come on and get to the... I have several things I need to go over with you here. Honey, I just want to be alone in my misery. Well, there's no time for that. You got to make these decisions right here. And so the Bible tells me that I have to let my banner wave over her in love. So I take this thing seriously and I say, well, honey, you're not going to do that. And, oh my, if looks could kill, I would have been dead many times. But listen, it comes down to the fact of the sufficiency of the Bible. And the Bible says that the husband is responsible. And one of the reasons that the Shulamith feels so good about the situation is that she's got a banner waving over her life. It's the banner of her husband's love. She feels safe in that. Now, I want to tell you, even when Miss Patterson gives me a hard time about a decision that goes differently than what she had in mind, she is ever more grateful to God that He gave me that responsibility, and she accepts it as unto God, even when she may not fully understand it. The banner over me was love. And then he comes to verse 6, which has been taken by many to have a sexual content to it. His left hand is under my head, and with his right hand he embraces me. But there is nothing necessarily sexually involved with embrace. There may be something there. Later on in the song, I'm going to show you where it almost definitely means that. Here it does not. Here it simply means that he holds me close. He gives me a sense of well-being. He makes it possible for me to negotiate life. Now, husbands, let me just say a word to you, or potential husbands. You are responsible for seeing to it that your family feels good about life. You are responsible for breeding into them trust for God and His providence that make it possible to feel good about life. Do you know what's going on? Yesterday, we had an election, and it didn't go the way I hoped it would in any states except Texas and Oklahoma. But the fact of the matter is that we are in a world of hurt. We are in upheaval. We've got a world that's at war with people cutting off folks' heads everywhere. And you got children that have got to be reared in that kind of atmosphere. And they must be prepared for the ultimate. But husband, you are responsible for teaching them the doctrine of the providence of God. God has not abdicated His throne. He is still in charge, no matter what the morning newspaper says. Whatever you read on your computer screen doesn't make any difference. It has not dethroned God. He is in charge, and you have the responsibility of making them feel at ease in the providence of God in the world. She feels comforted by his left hand under her head and the embrace of her right hand as he hugs her close. And she is moved to say, "I charge you, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the gazelles and by the does of the field." Look at those beautiful animals. There is a sweetness about the gazelles of the field. If you travel very much in the Judean wilderness, you will still see until this day that scene, a common scene in that day in which Solomon lived. They were everywhere, beautiful gazelles of the field. So I charge you by the gazelles and the does of the field, do not stir up nor awaken love until it pleases. Let this thing work itself out. Give it time and let him teach her to trust him and to trust the God that gave her to him. Well, the pleasures of love are many, and we should look for those pleasures of love, but there's also a playfulness to love. And many a couple simply has never learned to play together. And again, Miss Patterson, it's all-time work. And so I've had to work pretty hard to get her to learn to play. But oh my goodness, there is always a way. And whether it was going down the Nile River on the boat where she didn't have anything to work on and just had to sit and talk to me, or whether it is going to the ends of the earth. I've discovered that she loves to travel and she loves to see the various places of the world. So what am I going to do? Well, I'm not going to take her on a hunting trip, that's for sure. Not if I can help it anyway. But while she may not go on a hunting trip with me, she's going to be out there enjoying all these other things that I've been able to provide for her. And so I've had to help her learn to play. And by all means, don't forget the playfulness of love. Now, Shulamith says, the voice of my beloved. Behold, he comes leaping on the mountains. Skipping upon the hills. My beloved is like a gazelle or a young stag. We got one of those? Well, more of the same. There he is. Look at him. Oh, my. She said, I look up and I see my love. And oh, is he majestic, like a young stag. Can you imagine that thing out there? She looks up and that's what she thinks of, like a young stag. My beloved is like a gazelle or a young stag. Behold, he stands behind the wall and he's looking through the windows and gazing through the lattice. He's just sticking his head around and looking far. And then, just as she looks at him, he disappears again. Now he's over at the lattice work, and he's looking through the lattice. And then suddenly, he's gone. And every time she sees him, her heart goes out to him like that stag, that beautiful stag there. Oh, my. And then finally, my beloved spoke, and he said to me, rise up, my love, my fair one, and come away. You cannot live always in the level of work. There comes a time when you've got to come away. As Vance Havner used to say, if you don't come apart, you will come apart. And so there comes a time when you've got to go away. You need that special time with your sweetheart. You say, well, I'm broke. We've been there. We've been there when we didn't have a penny to our name. And yet, we found a way. Sure, it was Motel 6, but we found a way to get out there and get away. We've been able to do that all of our lives. And oftentimes, when we couldn't get away, it got so heavy as to be impossible to bear. Many of you are going to be in church work, perhaps most of you. I have news for you. That is not the Garden of Eden. It is a hospital for sick people. It is the only organization in the world you have to admit how bad you are in order to get into. Now, why did you expect that such a place as that would be a place of continual comfort for you? You are responsible for those people and for meeting their needs. But there comes a point where you need to be with your own spouse, when you need to be apart. And so Solomon, fresh from the kingship duties in Jerusalem, comes and says, rise up, my love, my fair one, and come away. The winter is past, and the rain is over and gone with the coming of springtime. Flowers appear on the earth, and the time of the singing has come, and the voice of the turtle dove is heard in the land. We got a turtle dove there? Yes, they're very commonly in the springtime. They are heard everywhere. If you look carefully, you can see those beautiful birds. The time of singing has come. Voice of turtle dove is found in the land. The fig trees put forth their green figs, and the vines with the tender grapes. I don't know whether we have some of those. Yeah, there's a big fig tree. And vines, do we have a vineyard there for them to see? I'm just trying to get you acquainted with all of these things that are mentioned in the Bible. You ought to have a curiosity about them. Well, the vines with their tender grapes give a good smell. Rise up, O love, my fair one, and come away. O my dove, in the clefts of the rock, in the secret places of the cliff, let me see your face. Let me hear your voice, for your voice is sweet and your face is lovely. You know, the last thing I do every night when I'm away from home, last thing I do every night is I call home. You say, well, you're doing that to assure your wife that you're behaving. Well, I imagine that she knows that that alone would not make me behave. But you know why I call home? I call home because I've probably gone all day flying on an airplane somewhere, and I have not heard her voice. I just need to hear her voice. There is a sweetness in her voice that I need to hear. It reminds me who I am. It reminds me what I'm about. And reminds me that if there were any temptation, it is infinitely not worth it. I must be faithful to her. You say, well, what do you do when you're overseas? If I'm overseas without her, last thing I do at night is to call my sweetheart. You say, well, I'd hate to see your long distance bill. You would hate to see it. But I want to tell you what, it's worth every penny of it to hear her voice late at night. So your voice is sweet and your face is lovely. There's a playfulness about love that is important. But now I want you to consider finally today the purposefulness of love. Catch us the foxes, the little foxes that spoil the vines, for our vines have tender grapes. The fox, oh my, the fox may be a jackal here, but it's 6 1/2 dozen the other. However, there is a definite reason to think that foxes were intended. Now, if you go to the Holy Land, you'll still run across the fox. I was at Arad one day, and I led the group over to the old discovery that has been made there. And as I walked down into it, suddenly two of these foxes came up, one jumped one way, one the other, right there in front of me. They are everywhere. They are the ultimate predator. They can live in the desert. They can live in the forest. They can live in the snows. They can live anywhere. And there is a peculiarity about the predator fox. The predator fox has developed an appetite specifically for grapes. And they're the biggest problem in the world. In the spring of the year, when the early grapes come on the vines, you have to watch constantly lest these foxes invade your vineyard and strip all of those grapes out of the vineyard. Well, she says, you need to catch the foxes. Well, how do you catch a fox? Well, you have to be pretty good, let me tell you that. When you read in the book of Judges that Samson captured 300 foxes, tied their tails together, and set them on fire, and ran them through the Philistine cornfields, you've got quite an accomplishment there. I have no idea how long it took him to capture all those. I sure don't know how he handled it when he was tying their tails together, because the general rule is that foxes take exception to that. And if they did not take exception to that, I feel relatively sure that having their tails set on fire was a major problem. But it shows you the predominance of the fox, and it shows you how good a man Samson really was. Well, she says, catch the little foxes that spoil the vines, for our vines have tender grapes. Now, I want to conclude the message today right there. She understands that it is not usually the big things that tear up a marriage. The little foxes that get into the vineyard, they are the problem. May I mention to you just a few of the little foxes that will ruin your life of love? The first one I want to mention is godlessness. It is impossible to be a happily married individual and a godless man at the same time. If you're a godless woman, I mean your life is not characterized by a walk with God, there are going to be problems in your marriage. Two human beings, very different, cannot live together for so long, and we've been at it a long, long time. Most of you know that I met Mrs. Patterson when she was 6. I was 7. We took her home from church one day, and when we let her out, I told my dad, "That's the girl I'm going to marry." And nobody thought anything about it, but neither one of us ever had a date with anybody else. Now, we didn't get formally married and consummate that marriage until his junior year in college, but all that time, we were together. And you can't live that long with another individual and not have some serious misgivings about things. You'll have problems. It's inevitable. If you don't think you will, well, just go ahead and get married, and you'll come tell me, yeah, we got problems. And so there are going to be problems. How do you handle it? You cannot handle it without a thorough and strong walk with God. If you live, I don't care if you do go to church, if you live without a devotional walk with God, it's a fox in your vineyard, and it will surely eat your grapes. Let me mention a second one. A second fox in the vineyard, busyness. Oh, I'm so busy, I just don't have time. Listen, anything that works takes time to make it work. Imagine the first time you ever rode a bicycle. How many of you just rode off on it without a problem? No, you probably fell, and certainly if you didn't do that, you were wobbly, and you had to work at it till you got it down. How'd you do the first day on the football field? Well, you got run over several times, and you're wondering what in the world's going on out here on the football field. You got to learn how to protect yourself and watch out. Some people are so busy that they don't have time for their life with their loved one, and you got to watch the busyness. Let me mention a third fox in the vineyard, and this one is devastating today. And that is pornography. Pornography will rob you of the grapes of your vineyard. It'll take them all away. I am speaking to many of you here today who have a problem with pornography. Pornography has been a problem ever since it's been around, which is at least since Rome. But now, today, things are different with the internet. Because in the privacy of your own space, you can Google up whatever you want to on the internet, and you will become involved in pornography. Seems innocent enough at first, but every time you look at pornography, you let a little fox in the vineyard, and your grape product begins to reduce itself. You say, well, I'm not even married yet. Yes, but you are setting a habit. Once I get married, I won't do it. And that's true. For the first 3 months you're married, you won't do it. But if you've established a habit of pornography, after 3 months, you'll be right back into it. World at end. I have people coming to me and confessing that they are deeply involved in pornography and it is ruining their marriage. Your marriage cannot stand the little foxes in the vineyard that bring pornography. You got to learn to hate pornography with all of your heart. Until you hate it, as long as you tolerate it, it will steal the grapes from your vineyard. Let me mention just two more out of so many. Watch out for counseling. You mean counseling can be a fox in the vineyard? You better believe it. For preachers, it's a major fox in the vineyard. You say, well, you know, you're such a, you're so determined legalist. You say don't you pastor or counsel a woman. I didn't say you couldn't counsel a woman. With your wife or her husband present, you can counsel the woman. And if she comes by herself and you have no choice about it, here's how you do it. You set one chair in the middle of Seminary Place out there, right on the line in the middle, and the other chair directly across from you in the middle of Seminary Place. And while the traffic is whizzing by on either side, you counsel with her there. You'll have no problem, and it won't be a long session either. And so you'll be able to do it just fine. Watch out. Gentlemen, you have no business counseling a member of the opposite sex in isolation. Just do not do it. It is a little fox in the vineyard. And finally, I want to mention selfishness. Selfishness is the misunderstanding of love. Selfishness says, I love for what I get out of it, not for what I give to it. And that selfishness will be a fox in your vineyard. Ladies, may I speak to you honestly? When you do not meet the needs of your husbands for physical intimacy, as sure as the world, you open the vineyard door and let the foxes go in. You are responsible for meeting those needs. Men, when you evaluate everything about your marriage in terms of sexual intimacy, that's a selfishness, and you open wide the door and usher the foxes into your little vineyard. And your grapes will soon be gone. If you don't remember anything else today about this message, I want you to remember the Shulamith's request. Catch the foxes that would come into the vineyard and eat the grapes, because they'll destroy your marriage. Well, happily, apparently, Solomon does that, and my beloved is mine, and I'm his, and he feeds his flock among the lilies, and until the day breaks and the shadows flee, turn my beloved like a gazelle or a young stag up on the mountains of Bether. Well, you all know how old I am. Maybe you haven't thought about it, but I can remember when television came in. Oh my, that's a long time ago. Do you know, I remember black and white television. You'd be bored. You'd be horrified by a black and white. But I want to tell you what, some of the greatest movies that ever came out black and white, low expenditure on set. Let me just give you one that many of you have not seen, but if you've seen it, you'll know exactly what I'm talking about. There was a movie that came out when I was a kid called High Noon. High Noon was quite a movie. You see, the sheriff of this particular town was about to get married. And oh dear, Grace Kelly is the one that he's marrying, and she appears so beautifully in this picture, and there's nothing that is revealing about it at all, just her priceless beauty there, dressed with her with a hat on and her beautiful flowing dress, and she is about to be married to the sheriff of the city. Just before they are married, there comes a telegram from another city. And a felon that he had incarcerated years ago has been set free from prison. And he has sworn that if it's the last thing he ever does, he's going to kill the sheriff. And he's getting on a train now and coming to the city. He'll be there by late in the afternoon. The marriage is complete. He tells his wife what the problem is, and she says to him, we must leave town now. And so, feeling his obligation to his wife, he agrees. The sheriff, Gary Cooper, in this case, says, okay, we will leave. And so they get the buckboard ready, and they get in shortly after noon, and They began to make their way out of town, well-wishers everywhere and waving to them, and they are gone. They come to the railroad track, and when they come to the track, it reminds the sheriff of his duty. This man is coming to kill him. He must go back and face him. He explains that to his wife. His wife is brokenhearted, and she says, "If you go back, I will not be here when you return." Tough choice. What does he do? In the background, Tex Ritter is singing, "Do not forsake me, O my darling, on this our wedding day. Do not forsake me, O my darling, wait, wait along. The noonday train will bring Frank Miller. If I am a man, I must be brave, and I must face that deadly killer. Are lie a coward, a craven coward, are lie a coward in the grave. Oh, to be torn twixt love and duty, supposing I lose my fair-haired beauty. Look at that big hand move, nearing high noon. He made a vow while in state's prison that it would be my life or his. I'm not afraid of death, but oh, what will I do if you leave me. Do not forsake me, oh my darling. You know that promise when we wed. Do not forsake me, oh my darling, though you're grieving. I can't be leaving until I shoot Frank Miller dead." He turned the buckboard around and drove back to town. She took the reins and she drove out of town. He goes to the church where all the people are gathered. He asks that they help him with the arrival of Frank Miller and the two gunmen coming with him. And all of those brave figures in the church said, "No, Frank Miller is too quick and we will not face him." It comes down to Gary Cooper facing Frank Miller and his two friends, and his bride has gone. What he doesn't know is that love is even greater than he realized. She gets to the edge of town and she cannot go. She turns around and comes back, and she is there when the gunfight occurs, and immediately goes out to her husband who survived. Folks, it's a parable of life. Life is not a bed of roses. Life is a series of challenges. And Christ makes the difference in your life and mine. And when we pledge our vows of marriage to one another, as, by the way, all of you will do again, if you're married, last sermon in this series, we're all going to get married again. And I'm going to do the marriage. In the process, I'm going to show you the vows of marriage that you need to have if you are unmarried yet. And, preacher, the vows of marriage that you need to use if you are doing the marrying. When we take those vows of marriage, we say that we are together for better or for worse from this day forward till death do us part. Have a love like Solomon and Shula, and you'll make it. God bless you.